haven't spoken. We spoke in the early days of the war, and a lot has changed since. I won't start listing all the developments since we spoke last, but maybe give me your general overview on how the war is going.
Well, you know, the war is only 3 weeks old, so I have to say that it's early days. We're still maybe in those early days. The war has, obviously, this conflict has expanded. It expanded exponentially. We're now into the destruction of the economic infrastructure of the region. That's the region being, in this case, from Israel to Iran. Israel started by hitting southern oil fields. Trump, I think, is playing a good cop, bad cop. They're still trying to do incremental escalation, trying to control escalation. We'll hit the oil fields, but they didn't have our permission. Don't hit back. Don't worry. It's not going to happen again. Typical incrementalism. Iran came back with, as it had warned, any attack on our oil fields or gas fields, and we're just going to hit everybody, everywhere there's any U.S. bases or anything of the sort. And they've done that. They're making it, their job here is to purge the U.S. out of the Persian Gulf by A, destroying the American bases, and they're doing a good job of that. First of all, having blinded the U.S. By destroying, and Israel, by destroying the radars. Two, they're making it very expensive for anybody who wants to host U.S. bases. They've said flat out, expel the Americans, yeah, that's it, you're neutral to us. Keep the Americans in, and you know we're not going to hold back. And that's something that has been pushed very hard onto these Gulf state Arabs. And when Israel hit the infrastructure, Iran hit, and they also hit, let's not forget, Israel also hit a nuclear power plant, the one that Russia is building. A little while, about a week ago, Israel created a giant biological, chemical catastrophe for the whole region. When they destroyed the oil, that's right. When they destroyed that, not only did that 9 million people get covered in oil and soot, that black rain that was coming down, it's carcinogenic. I've talked to people there that said their coughs have started, things like that. But that cloud has gone on. It covered Central Asia. It's gone into Pakistan, Afghanistan, northern India. Came up into as far as Kazakhstan in the north, the wind dispersing it. You're looking at contamination of farmland, pasture land, possible carry-on effects that may last at least one generation. People are going to be drinking water, eating plants, no matter. So, you know, this is something. If there is an Israel after all of this, the way things are going, that's something that they're going to be facing. I think massive lawsuits from every one of these countries because they basically pissed everybody off doing something like that, and they knew it was going to happen. You can't tell me they didn't know that setting ablaze that much oil was not going to have the consequences it had. I just don't think they care in the least. We see what they're doing in Lebanon. We see what they're doing in Beirut, particularly. They're trying to Gaza the entire southern Lebanon and Beirut. They're now hitting Christian sections, so the Christian militias that have previously set out this conflict between Hezbollah and Israel are now being involved, whether they like it or not. True, they're not exactly a very powerful military, but that's just something added on that I highly doubt they'll sit this one out as Israel continues to bomb Christian neighborhoods and murder Christians, both the Orthodox and Catholics. They've closed the Church of Sepulchre. I always butcher that name. The empty tomb. Of all the churches, that's probably the holiest church for Christianity, with Orthodox Pascha and Catholic Easter right on the nose. So that's hasn't happened in 2,000 Lebanon? Years. In Jerusalem.
Okay. Yep.
That they've closed that down since the 28th of February. So we see this is escalating in every single direction because now you've pulled in the Christian elements after they assassinated Khomeini. They pulled in the Hezbollah Shia elements. So this is growing. And now that you have an economic catastrophe, I'm not going yet into possible ground force invasion, which is as insane as it that could be, but looks like it's actually going to happen. That I'll get to that in a minute. The economic damage that we're seeing is going to have fallouts for the next years to come. I was a supply chain director for two American gas oil services companies. I was in Cameron. I was a supply chain director, and I was a regional director for Halliburton over Eurasia. And then I was a director in supply chain for an Italian EPC company, engineering, procurement, construction, the technical construction. So I know what it takes to expand an oil refinery. I know what it takes, how much time it takes to get equipment to build up a wellhead and that infrastructure. And I was also director of supply chain on the project for building one of the three phases of the LNG refinery in Amur, which is one of the biggest in the world. So I understand the timelines that are involved in this and getting the equipment, this, because I've lived through this. And if the damage is as extensive as what we've seen on all sides, we're looking at years, not months, years before anything gets even near to what it was before, and possibly a year to 2 years before anything is being produced at all, because this is a massive amount of damage. This equipment, I mean, just as an example, when we were expanding the Moscow refinery to add another section to it to produce E95 petrol, the vessels, and there were about 140 vessels that are involved in this process. They varied from 1 meter to 78 meters in length. These are all constructed by hand, welded by hand. You're looking at about a half a year time frame to get that much out of one of the bigger producers in Russia. And then part of it was also coming in from Grand Mechanica, Italy, which is very low quality, and we had to redo a lot of that work. But then infrastructure for metal construction, so on, you're looking at a year and a half project just there. And that's not counting, and that was just for one section of an existing refinery. And that's not counting having to clean up any damaged infrastructure and anything of the sort. So if we're looking at massive damage, for example, on the LNG plant, in Qatar, it may be 2-3 years before they're producing, depending on just from the flames and the look of it. It looked, and the images from the missile strikes, it looked pretty damn damaged. And then you got to figure, you know, a lot of these metal suppliers, construction suppliers, especially if they, the Russians will more likely than the Chinese be replacing and putting Iran back on its legs. Who's going to be doing it for the rest of the Persian Gulf? Definitely it's not going to be Europeans, because it's gas heavy manufacturing for steel manufacturing. So maybe the Americans, but the Americans can't do it all by themselves. It's going to take years to put all this up. So we're looking at a massive cut in the amount of energy, even if the Straits of Hormuz are open tomorrow and everything's hunky-dory and everybody sits down and has a beer together. You're looking at a year and a half, maybe year and a half, maybe 2 years before production starts getting to where it was. So you're looking at a world that literally now has 20% less LNG, which for Europe is a disaster. And Russia's turning its back on Europe, because Europe's been, Europe's been what Europe's been. And Putin is now talking about, I'm not going to wait to January 27 for you to cut off procurement. We're just going to leave now. Have fun. Europe is looking at losing about 47% of its LNG, of its gas in general, because most of it's not LNG. And if the Ukrainians are successful in ever blowing up any of the pumping station for Turkstream, Europe is going to be cut off by another 20%. It's dead in the water. European industry, anyways, will be dead in the water, because that's 80% of all energy, gas in this case, the usage is normally heavy industry, not for heating homes. That's a 20% use on average in industrial society. And then you're looking at just sections of the world that A, is not going to have enough oil. That's going to cause resource wars and conflicts on its own and instability. And B, Europe may face starvation this year. At least now I'm not talking maybe whole nation starving, but actual social class starvation, like the lower classes that already have. It is. It's going to be a massive food crisis. We're going to see that in 6 months. Because Russia is 40% of the world's chemical fertilizer, which without that, you wouldn't have the Green Revolution. And Qatar was 20% or almost 30%. So the EU just cut off 70%. By the way, the US last year bought $500 million worth of fertilizer from Russia, and that's expanding its procurement. So the US has no problem with this. It'll level sanctions and nullify them for whatever long term it needs it. So it's very flexible. The Europeans, on the other hand, are ideologues to an insane degree, the European leadership, and they'll rather watch their population suffer than back off on their psychotic ideologies, including the Green Revolution, which is a dead end revolution. That's, recyclables are not recyclable, as people think. They're worse for the environment than the technology that exists, interestingly enough. So we're looking at massive upheavals that are going to be coming down the line. Now,
I want to just go through some of the points. You've mentioned a lot. I want to start with the first thing you said. You said this is the early days of the war. So you're under the impression that this is going to be a prolonged conflict. Why?
There are several reasons. First of all, Trump's looking for an off-ramp, and the Iranians are not in no mood to give him an off-ramp. The Iranians said, whatever the Iranians said, we're going to continue. We're not asking for peace. We're definitely not asking for a ceasefire. We're going to continue this conflict until we decide this conflict is no longer in our interest and we've reached our ends. We can take the damage. We can go for, you know, they've even one point said we could keep this up to November in your elections, which would be a catastrophe and then some. Trump is desperately looking for an off-ramp, so are the neocons, because everything went wrong from what they thought they were going to get. They thought they were going to get a nicely, nice, clean decapitation, and then everything, we'll just put our guy in, a new dictator, even if we want to call him a Shah, it'll still be a dictator, it'll give us all the resources, and it will be rich. Basically the same idiotic plan they had with sanctions for Russia. You know, 2 weeks, 2 months, Russia will be on its knees. Well, 4 years later, and guess who's on their knees? It's not Russia. So this is the same thing. Lots of wishful thinking, very little understanding of your opponent, and just, you know, non-realistic planning. And I can tell you from my own experience, when I was in 18th Airborne Corps, some of the computerized exercises we were doing, 18th Airborne Corps, which is the 82nd Airborne, 101st Airborne, 10th Mountain, and 3rd Mechanized, the only division that has tanks and Bradleys, were tasked to stop, theoretically stop a Russian field tank army, which is impossible. I mean, the only way it won was in the middle of the night while the generals were asleep and there's only one or two colonels on duty. You go in the computer system and you go 70% losses, 70% reinforcements, 100% resupply. Bingo! And then the next day you go, oh, look, we can do this. We can win. Because you're cheating. They're not looking at us realistically. And then the generals high-five each other, and they send a report to the Pentagon. Yeah, we can take a Russian tank army out, which is ludicrous, but that's how the U.S. military has been running for the last 30 years, or maybe longer. You know, my experience anyway, was 30 years. This is the type of insanity that they – and they start to believe their own hype, which is dangerous. The Iranians have – but what the Iranian condition – that they've said, you know, they've gave a condition. We want, we don't, no ceasefires, nothing like what happened in July. We want negotiated terms of peace and dearmament of the U.S. in the Persian Gulf. But what they really said on top of that was reparations. And I'll tell you this, most American senators would rather eat their own liver for dinner than pay reparations to Iran, because that is the ultimate humiliation for the U.S. if they have to pay reparations. But they don't know what to do to get out of this. So now we're looking at ground troops. Looks like the 82nd Airborne is being going to be within the next 2 days deployed into the Middle East. You've got about 5,000 Marines coming in. But this is a meat grinder suicide mission. And Trump, the greatest war leader ever, who, by the way, got 5 deferments from Vietnam, God forbid he actually put the real uniform on, is going to lead these men or going to send these men. He's not going to lead them. It's going to send them to their slaughter. This is going to be a disaster writ large.
Did you say you were part of the 82nd Airborne when you were in the military?
I was 18th Airborne Corps. That's the headquarters that the 82nd belongs into.
Okay, so can you tell me more about the 82nd Airborne, which are being dispatched to the region? What are their capabilities and what does that indicate? Are there? Would they be more focused on Karg Island, other islands in the region, or is it more of a special operation within Iran that could lead to the capture of the enriched uranium? No one's talking about the capture of the enriched uranium now. It started off as that was the discussion initially. Now it's all about Karg Island.
Well, let me just illusion anybody that thinks you're going to take out that enriched uranium. Stop watching Hollywood movies. That's quote unquote, pardon my French, bullshit. It's never going to happen. It's impossible to do. The reality of it, it's outside of watching Mission Impossible or Bourne Identity or one of these other movies, it can't be done.
Why?
Very simple. Fly into the middle of Iran, which, by the way, has active air defenses. The one F-35 just found out about that, even though Trump keeps saying they don't longer work. Fly in the middle of Iran with helicopters. How else are you going to get there? Fight your way through an underground complex. You have to get in there. Fight your way through its security forces and whatever forces then are going to be pulled into the middle. Because, by the way, you don't have any supplies except what you're carrying with you. And then carry out 450 kilos of uranium, which, by the way, is highly radioactive, so it has to be in a containment unit. So you're looking at least a 1,000 kilos, a ton of material you have to pull up from I don't know where, how deep in a mountain, and then in a mountain fortress, and then load it on helicopters, and then fly several hundred kilometers back out. I mean, we're talking about a country that's the size of France and Germany combined, and throw in Italy, too, while you're at it. And you're going to fly in the middle of there somewhere in a mountain range with helicopters, not get shot down by something as simple as a igla, which is similar to a stinger that anybody can have, or be just shot down by light arms fire and fly out. It's Mission Impossible. I mean, it's quite literally mission. Special forces operators, they work when they control the entire environment. It's not Hollywood. They go banging and shooting and everything else. They'll go blow a bridge up. They'll assassinate somebody. They'll train the locals. But it's a very controlled environment. But by the way, most of the time, they don't get involved in firefights because they have very specific skill sets. They are always outnumbered. And if they get bogged down by even the cheapest troops, they will get slaughtered. Ammunition will end. They will not get out. Because any enemy operation like that, you're outnumbered 100, 200, 500 to 1. You're not going to bring a division in the middle of Iran. And again, it would have to be by helicopter. How else would you get the guys down and then get them back up and 1,000 kilos of equipment and uranium? So that's a Mission Impossible. It's not going to happen. You could try to force a convoy in there. But then again, considering it's several hundred kilometers across mountains, Iran is 70% mountain ranges. The chances of that succeeding are about zero, or actually negative, if you can go that far. So it's not going to happen. So what are you down to? 82nd Airborne is a light infantry division. They used to have light tanks, Sheridan tanks. Those tanks were retired back in the mid-90s. They tested several replacement tanks that were air deployable, so you could drop them with parachutes, and chose none. So now they have absolutely no even light armor backup. They're a foot infantry division, deployable by parachute. Again, you're going to do what with you can do limited objectives with them. Say drop them off on Karg Island with huge amount of casualties. By the way, let's face reality on that. You're not going to take on the Iranian army in Iran, Iranian army that is, with the militias that they've now mobilized, about 2 million men on home turf in defensive positions, prepared defensive position, have been preparing for 20 years in the mountains with, what, about 10, 12,000 men? It's a slaughter. Now, if you take Karg Island, here's the problem with Karg Island. First of all, look on the map. Karg Island is all the way on the other side of the Persian Gulf. Persian Gulf is not that small. It's all the way on the other side of the Persian Gulf. Any approaches, you're going to get spotted. It's flat. It's pretty flat. I mean, it's got a little bit of terrain in it, but there's no hills and no mountains. It's urban buildup. There's even a water park there if you look closely. Nestorian Church, mosques, various urban environment in the northeast where the airstrip is. By the way, they bombed the airstrip. Trump had the airstrip bombed, so now you can't land C-130s on there without repairs. That wasn't a very thought-through plan. So now you're down to what? You can do C-130s overhead, and they're a relatively slow-moving plane. That's a nice, fat target. You can do C-130s overhead, dropping the airborne in and dropping supplies airwise. You can do the Ospreys that can come in there, the tilt-wing helicopter/planes. But again, they're not exactly super fast either. You could do helicopter deployments from there. But again, look what you're look. Let's see what you're facing just to land on this island. Number one, there's going to be Stinger teams, or in this case, Igla teams all over the place. You've got troops on there, so you're going to be fighting for terrain. You're going to fight for the beachhead, and then you have to clear building by building, including industrial zones, to get there. Helicopters are going to be lost. Planes are going to be lost. Igla will easily take out a C-130. Any air defense systems that they have in the area that they haven't switched on or kept underground that's on the mainland is 36 kilometers away from the center of Carr Island to just past the beaches, 37, depending on which angle you look at. Guess what goes 50 kilometers right now on the line of contact in Russia and Ukraine? Drones. Heavy drones, FPV drones, the four quads, they go 50 kilometers with a large battery pack and a nice RPG round underneath them. And then guess what happens? It's not just Russia, it's not just Ukraine that has those drones on each other. The Iranians will be waiting on the shoreline across from Karg Island, and it becomes a shooting spree or a turkey shoot, as they say in the U.S., particularly in the south. These guys are going to be chased by drones all over this Karg Island. This is a disaster. There's no forest to hide in.
So just quickly, where are they going to come from? Because I know that Karg Island was already bombed heavily. All the military installations have been bombed. Also, there's not that many troops on there. You know, prior to the war, there were estimates, and no one knows for sure, low thousands or in the hundreds in terms of Iranian troops. Not sure how many they'll be there, whether they evacuated or they've reinforced. And third is, you're talking about drones. I know that they'll be targeted to artillery, but you're saying drones will be launched from where? From the Iranian coastline, from Badr, all the places, Badr is the closest city. So from that coastline towards Karg Island, it seems a pretty long distance. I'm not sure if the drones could
36 kilometers. 36 kilometers.
Is that enough for the Shahed drones and all other drones with a GPS?
No. We're not talking Shahed drones. Shahed drones could go several hundred kilometers easily, 300-400 kilometers. The new drones that Russia is providing, the Garand 3, can go 500-600 kilometers. That's not an issue. I'm not even talking about big drones. Listen to what I'm saying. I'm talking about FPV drones, the four rotors on four wings drones. Those are used for 50-kilometer range. Easily. Now, you don't need it. No, you could do fiber optics, sure, but why? You can do it without fiber optics. Fiber optics actually can lead back to where the person is, though, again, across that kind of region, it's kind of hard. But, special forces on the Russian side, they find Ukrainian fiber optic operators by finding the wire and banging, throwing the wire, and you see the if it's a clear sun, you'll see the sun rays shining off of that wire, so you can kind of go follow it. That's one of those little tricks. Both sides are using that. That's not any big secret. That can create, and it creates problems for motorcycles and vehicles too, because you get thousands of these all over a big portion of the field. But no, I'm talking about radio operated. Look, 36 kilometers, you don't need a big army unit. You know what you need? You need 100 teenagers who've lost their parents, have lost their brothers and sisters. You plant one under a tree, one under a bush, one in some house, on a roof somewhere, across the water lines. You give them a dozen drones each. Let's play a game. Let's chase an American, the 82nd Airborne Trooper or a Marine on Karg Island. That's the new game. And you've watched 200 drones and a wave coming across, and you try to stop all that. Sure, some will get stopped. A lot of them will get through, and there'll be a lot of casualties. And then next, the question, how do you get these casualties off the island? The heat, there's water issues, food issues, keeping them provisioned. How do you get the casualties out? When everything is within drone-operated range, this is the reality of the modern battlefield. The Americans have done a very good job of ignoring reality, so is NATO in general. They're about to strike into that reality, a reality we've lived with for the last 4 years. Where are you going to go? You're going to have how do you triage your wounded when drones are overhead constantly? How do you get them out? You have to bring in helicopters or Ospreys. By the way, they're coming in. They're vulnerable to drones. We've lost helicopters. The Russian side has lost helicopters to drones. The Ukrainians have lost plenty of helicopters to drones. Again, FPV drones. An FPV drone with an RPG round striking a helicopter, goodbye helicopter. So that's this little problem. Yeah, you could still get them on there with losses, but what do you do? How do you supply them? How do you get the wounded off of there? It's always easy to step into quicksand. It's a hell of a lot harder to get out of it. And Karg Island is just going to be a turkey shoot for all these drone operators. And again, where are they sitting there? You know, it's a couple of teenagers with VR goggles control and a dozen drones here, another couple houses over under some bush there. That's a long coastline. They could be anywhere. You can't bomb everything.
I just thought the limited range of the FPV drones make them difficult without fiber optics. But you're saying it's not hard to develop FPV drones that could reach Karg Island, 30 whatever kilometers.
Oh, they already are. The difficulty is in line of sight communications and having a large enough battery pack that they can fly that far. When you can put up larger drones, what the Ukrainians use, the Baba Yaga, Russia has its own larger drones that retranslate the signal. It's like an internet retranslator. So you bounce a signal off the drone, it bounces back to the operator, and you extend their range. Effective range right now on the battlefield is up to 50 kilometers from the battlefield. You can get drones in. I mean, I've been in Avdiivka when enemy drones flying overhead and then being shot down, and that happens every day. And Avdiivka is about the medium rear. The front is 30 kilometers further west. Yeah, and drones fly every single day over there from the Ukrainian side, and Russian drones fly deep in. And that's, again, without loitering munitions and other types of warhead. This is just regular FPV drones. Technology's moved advanced ahead quite a bit. So, I mean, that's what these guys are going to be facing. They're going to be facing being attacked by drones day and night. Drones are cheap. Night optics these days are not expensive to put on a drone. Day and night, they're going to have drones coming in. Again, you can't cover the entire coastline to try to find that 1, 2, 10, 20, 50 kids or Iranian soldiers who are going to be launching drones over and over and over. That's a little problem. Now, if the reason you have fiber optic is because they're harder to jam. In fact, you can't use the radio signal jammers on the fiber optic because their signals are coming down the fiber optic line. You could do that. And fiber optical drones can go 30, 40 kilometers because they're bigger ones. They'll have a bigger spool of fiber optic cable in the back. You may have to put a slightly smaller charge on them versus an RPG. You know, you may be a smaller RPG round like an RPG 6 or an RPG 4. But you can put a smaller mine on there to explode, but to make up for the weight of the spool. But it's not that heavy. So there's the problem. You can cover Karg Island. By the way, same thing if they try to take the coastline of the Straits of Hormuz. It's going to be a turkey shoot. No prepared positions. You're out in the open ahead of your mountains. And guess what's coming off the mountains? You're having FPV drones. I'm not even talking about heavier drones like Shahids or Garan 3s that can come down and strike larger targets. I'm not talking about loitering munitions. Yeah, I mean, this is the reality. And if you can't suppress and push them out, you know, you're just on an island.
So, but the goal is to take these islands throughout the Strait of Hormuz and use those, you know, install radars in those islands to be able to intercept any missiles or drones, to be able to reset your control of a kind of a controlled buffer zone for the ships to be able to pass through, prevent Iran from being able to strike the ships. So that is the objective. But what you're saying is that, number one, the American troops in those islands will become sitting ducks for drones. And by the way, you're not the only one that said that, as well as artillery. You didn't talk about maybe you mentioned it, all the artillery guns on the coastline as well, and the ongoing missile strikes that Iran continues to strike with the Gulf. It could use very short range missiles for these islands.
Right. The short range missiles are more likely what you're going to be winding up from the heavier aspect. The problem with tube artillery, even if it's deployed on an elevator, shaft is it self-identifies the moment it fires because you have radar systems that can are set out in front and they can study the trajectory velocity. It's a ballistic round, so you've got a parabolic curve on it, and you can study out where it came from by velocity, by speed, by angle of approach, and you can kind of figure out where the enemy is and attack those locations. That's what you get A-10s or F-15s on standoff that can launch missiles into that location. That's problem with tube artillery. On the other hand, rocket artillery, you drive out somewhere, you shoot, and the moment that rocket takes off, you're gone. You're on your way out. By the time anybody can track a ballistic missile out from where it came from, there's nobody there anymore. That's by the way, self-propelled artillery works the same way. It stops for 2 minutes to fire or less, depends how many rounds it wants to fire, and keeps going. By the time counter-battery artillery comes in, there's nothing there. You're just shooting into an empty field or an empty building or an empty forest line. And that's the problem when you have mechanized. If you have tube artillery that's planted in an area, if it lifts off an elevator, you can identify where it's coming from. And that becomes a problem. But rocket artillery, yeah, it'll do a lot of damage. Even something as basic as a Grodd system that can pump 120-millimeter rockets on top, a dozen 120-millimeter rockets on top of a grid square. Now, having said that, let's look at the Straits of Hormuz realistically. The main dredged route, the Straits of Hormuz are not deep. There is a main dredged route that goes around the tip. It is 2,700 meters wide. That's what all your tankers and any heavier ships would have to traverse down that route. It's not hard to close down. It's actually quite easy to close down. If you sink one or two of them, now they're going to be in the way of anything else coming down. And you have to dredge them out. You're not going to dredge them under fire. So the Iranians have, I mean, you have to, theoretically, if you really want to take control, you need to drop enough troops to go up in the mountains and keep pushing them back at least 30 kilometers from the coastline, if not 40 kilometers. U.S. does not have the strength for that, nor the U.S. When the casualties start coming in the thousands, as the U.S. is going to be, or the Donald Trump administration going to be able to handle this. Never mind how to feed, supply the soldiers that have to do this. Look, you know, when you had D-Day, you had 125,000 troops coming in. You had manufactured ports that were towed over, and their job wasn't to take the beach. Their job was to take the battle positions behind the beach and keep pushing the Germans back as far as they could away from the beach, for a reason that the Germans couldn't then shell the beach from. And that was cliffs in one area and just a small hillock in another area of the beach. Depends what part of the beach you're in. But either way, after that, it was relatively flat. Well, they had a lot of hedgerows, but it wasn't a mountain. It wasn't a mountain range. So we're talking an absolutely different aspect. And, you know, we're first there was 125,000 a landing. You're going to land, what, 10,000 against an entrenched enemy in the mountains? It's suicide. It is absolute suicide. It's a butcher's bill that the U.S. is going to have to pay for ethereal gains.
What can you, is there any comparisons we can make to the Iran-Iraq war where Iran had hundreds of thousands of troops? Iraq and was still not able to invade Iran and still lost the war. What was Iran's strategy in that war? I'm not sure if you know the details.
You know, Iraq did invade Iran. That's the whole point. They did. And they invaded first and primarily in the southwest of the northern tip near Kuwait, because that's more or less flat lands and there's a lot of oil fields in that area. And Iraq was pushed on and supplied by the U.S. And yes, it went back and forth. Iran did not have a lot of armor, so it used infantry, used a lot of infantry suicidal charges. I mean, it played with the cards it was dealt with, the equipment that it held. U.S. Was supplying Iraq. In fact, so was the Soviet Union supplying Iraq. Iraq had the technological advantage. Iran had the human capital. And yes, Iraq lost that war. It was pushed out. It took heavy casualties. That's when the U.S. started supplying Iraq with chemical weapons. And Iraq killed almost 1 million people with chemical weapons. Also killed Kurds. It also killed the swamp Arabs who are Shia. They used chemical weapons in every single direction. And the U.S. was happy with that. They had no problems with that. So that, one of the reasons that Saddam didn't think the U.S. was actually going to invade him, because just 2 years earlier, they were the best of friends. And Rumsfeld was over there and Cheney was over there at various times. Shaking Sand Cheney was the Minister of Defense or Secretary of Defense. Let me phrase that, under George Bush Sr. Let's not forget that. So, yeah, they had that effect. But, you know, what the point is here that everybody's ignoring is the U.S. and Israel accomplished regime change, generational regime change. They took out the older generation that wanted to talk to them, that was willing to negotiate with them. And they replaced them with the 50-somethings. The 50-somethings like Khomeini, who spent when he was 17, went to the front as a volunteer infantryman. These are the guys that spent their youth, that was formed their youth, watching their friends die as they fought the American proxy in Iraq. These are the people that were hardened by war since they were 16, 17 years old. This is the people that are now running Iran. They're not going to back off. They want revenge. They want justifiable revenge. Because, again, let's remember one thing. When's the last time Iran started a war on its own? When's the last time Iran started a war with somebody? 200 years ago. When's the last time the U.S. started a war? Half a year ago, not counting this one. U.S. has spent almost an entire history fighting somebody. It's got like about 13, 14 years of no wars. Iran had 200 years. It didn't start wars. I'm not saying it didn't fight wars because wars were started against it. But it was 200 years. It did not initiate any conflicts. So this is a very different country. This is a country where the people are defending their homeland from their women and children being murdered by indiscriminate shelling. You're talking absolutely different levels of motivation. U.S. does not have a moral high ground. There was no rally around the flag for the president. That's why they're constantly changing the reason for this war, because they don't know how to sell it to the public. And if they have to go with a draft, and apparently they're not considering a draft, you're going to have massive civil unrest, if not a civil war in the U.S., because the majority of the population is against it. So that'll be very interesting to see. But when the butcher's bill comes due, if they're crazy enough to do this, I don't know how Trump stays in power, honestly speaking. A lot of Republicans will abandon. Nancy Graham there. Lindsey, he'll run off the moment he feels that he's threatened. Believe you me, he's a rat, and he's got a rat that's looking out for himself first and foremost. Trump just happens to be a convenient ship for him to sail on at the moment. And remember, he was one of the anti-Trumpers at his own time. So, I mean, a lot of these Republicans, by their own political logic, they will abandon Trump in a heartbeat. They follow him because he's popular, not because they like him. And they're going to look out for their own skins, first and foremost. So when this goes south, that support for the imperial presidency is going to get real thin.
Do you think, I'm just looking at the various comments on where the claims of America implementing a draft, but just a last question on that front, on the ground invasion. Do you think it will happen, if you had to guess based on everything you've said? And then I want to get your thoughts on Iran's military strategy as well, and the strikes on the Gulf, the retaliation to the gas plant attack as well by Israel. But first, do you think you will see troops on the ground?
If we had a logical regime in Washington, no, this wouldn't happen. It's suicide. Anybody, any general that's worth his weight, that's not out looking. Well, unfortunately, they're all political. That's how they get chosen these days. Any general that understands that should be resigning in protest, they won't, because resigning in protest means no more prospects of million-dollar careers after military service. That's the unfortunate part about the American system these days. Again, if anybody looks at this realistically, logically, in a sound mind, they would never do this. Will they do it? You know, I don't know. I pray that they're smart enough not to do this for the casualties on both sides. But the U.S. is looking at a meat grinder it's not prepared to deal with. By the way, there's pretty much a blackout on news in the U.S. I mean, any real news on what's going on. So as happens in every war. I mean, if you ask the average American, in 2014, 2015, 2012 about Afghanistan, he'd probably ask you, we're still there? I mean, that's the level of news blackout on all of these things. Very, very minimal. And they just avoid talking about it. And it just goes away because they block off the airways with everything else. Now, of course, the Americans are facing about 30% rise in the cost of gasoline. And that petrol isn't going to go down anytime soon. I mean, the U.S. could put price ceilings in. They could put export controls in. But then the donor class would lose money. And that takes a lot of willpower off the from the president to actually do that.
By the way, just quick update. So as you're speaking, just kind of give you an idea of the war. Like, there was ballistic missile launched towards southern Israel from Iran. So as you fired the interview, Hezbollah claimed to have struck an IDF tank. Minutes later, ballistic missiles launched from Iran towards southern Israel. And then minutes after that, literally simultaneously, alerts are sounding in Dubai, and reports of air defense interceptions in the Marina area. Yeah, that hits close to home because that's where I live. But yeah, that's all happening as we're speaking. It kind of links to the next point, is what could Iran do? And I want to start with another question I've been thinking about. And that's, Iran still has enriched uranium hidden somewhere. We've mentioned it early on in the interview.
Sure.
It's at about 60% enriched uranium. Now, to get it to 90% takes a couple of weeks, depending who you ask. And that amount of enriched uranium is enough for 10 to 12 bombs. So putting all that together, is there a possibility, is there a risk that Iran, if it's boxed into a corner, or even now, that they develop some sort of, you know, small nuclear warhead and use that either as a deterrent or either as a strike to try to end the war? Because a lot of people are talking about Israel using a nuclear warhead, which I think is extremely unlikely, but I'm surprised how many people are actually bringing it up. But I'd like to get your thoughts on that as well, but mainly on the Iranian risk.
Well, if Israel uses a nuclear warhead, there's a nuclear power plant about 100 kilometers, 120 kilometers south of Jerusalem. That nuclear power plant will be destroyed, and that's going to cause nuclear meltdown in the core, and you're going to have fallout in that region. Israel's pretty small. Sure, it'll go outside that region, but it'll still hit. I think this time of year, the winds are going more northwest, so it would still cover Tel Aviv, areas like that. And never mind the ballistic reserves that Iran has, would still wipe out a very good chunk of Israel.
If they have the launchers, we don't know if we have enough launchers.
Well, they have plenty of launchers. I mean, come on, the missiles are going. The reason is, look, the reason you're not having this big of a launcher launches right now is you're in phase three. Phase two, most of the you launch in the phase one, you wipe out the eyes, the radar systems. So you go from having a 40-minute window of notification and opportunity to react to about a 3 to 4 minute window of opportunity to react, because that's the radar systems have been destroyed. Now you're looking at what phase two then becomes. You just keep shooting and shooting, not so much to necessarily the hit as to use up the enemy's defensive missile capabilities. That's when Hezbollah can launch 200 missiles and 25% of those get through, because Iron Dome is worn out, arrows worn out. U.S. is pulling PAC-2 missiles into the Patriots, the older missiles that aren't really designed for ballistic missile interception, just to have something to be able to shoot. The THAADs are out, and the U.S. manufacturing base is pathetic when it comes to this. I mean, look, the U.S. hand manufactures missiles, by the way, because that's how you maximize the cost of these missiles and maximize the profit. Patriot missiles are produced at about 35 to 40 missiles a month. THAADs are produced at about 9 to 10 missiles a month at $12 million a missile. By the way, that's nothing. That's not even one night's worth in a month if you shift everything there. The S-4s are the SA-4s are pretty much so done. You still have SA-6s on the larger ships and aircraft carriers. But you know those aren't being used. They're kept in the back to keep them out of missile range. So what do? At this point, there's nothing for the Arabs. There, you can put up the only thing you have left is you can put up F-16s in the air and use their air-to-air missiles to try to take out these larger drones and take out the ballistic missiles. Not the best choice to do it, but they can be done. But you know, you're going to go through air-to-air missiles pretty damn quick if you do it that way. And I think they are doing it this way at this point. When you get to phase three is when you start pulling out the new toys. You've used up the old toys. You still have, you use up what's left and you start putting out the new toys. And then, for example, the hypersonics. And then you're just doing, you're doing targeted hits on exact targets. Instead of saturation runs, you don't need to do it. Now you're starting to do targeted, targeted destruction of enemy facilities, enemy personnel, and so on. That's the phase we're in now. Iran has plenty of missiles. I've seen the videos of the tunnels. The U.S. is being, like it or not, U.S. is being proxied back by Russia and China. And why not? U.S. has proxied Russia for 4 years. What goes around comes around.
I've asked this question to a lot of people. You think China and Russia are using Iran to proxy the U.S., to weaken the U.S.?
Why not? Absolutely. U.S. does it to Russia. And here we go, we'll do it to China the first moment they have. In fact, it does it through a company, through an organization like USAID, trying to get
it can't do it to a billion.
So, yes.
It can't. So two things. Number one, it's doing it through China, through Taiwan, by defending Taiwan, but it's not directly doing it the same way as Ukraine, because China is not part of any ongoing war, hasn't been for decades. So that's why you can't
drive China for proxy war
when there's no war.
There's Western Turkmenistan, or basically Western edges of China that has a Muslim population. The U.S. has been trying to proxy that for a long time, rise up rebellions, and through Tibet also. So, yes, the U.S. does that. The U.S. has been trying to push India into a war with China for years now. The Indians just happen to be a bit smarter than to go into a suicidal war with China. So, hopefully that'll continue. The
previous question and the last question is the risk of a nuclear bomb by Iran. Do you think that this is a risk that should be taken into consideration as well? Because not many people are talking about it, unless I'm missing something militarily.
Look, the guy that kept the moderate, that kept nuclear weapons as forbidden, was killed on day one by the Israelis or by the Americans. I'm not sure who struck him first. I think it was the Israelis. His son, who fought since 17, he can go around that far. He's now the religious leader. And I think more like, you know, if I was running Iran, I'd have already had nuclear weapons. Different between Iran and North Korea. North Korea can reach out and touch Alaska. They can reach out and touch Hawaii. They can definitely take out any American allies and bases within East Asia, down possibly to Guam. And the U.S. isn't going to touch them. They're not going to touch them because they're afraid of them, because they have nuclear weapons and they will strike back.
But in terms of Iran, the difference. Just quickly, on the fatwa, the fatwa is it's a religious statement, a religious ruling that can be reversed. Yes. So the new Supreme Leader can reverse it. And then if... And also there's an argument being made by the people that believe Iran could be building nuclear weapons is that if you don't want to build nuclear weapons, why enrich to 60% in the first place? My answer is this is a deterrent. This is more of a threat. Like if you twist our arm, exactly. If you twist our arm, we will build a nuclear weapon. If you don't twist our arm, if you don't attack us, we won't build one. Well, the arm has been twisted and the war has been started. So does that mean there's the incentive to build a nuclear bomb, whatever your stance is on Iran, the incentive from a self-preservation perspective is there, and the risk should be taken into consideration?
Absolutely. Look, if I was running the show, I would be developing nuclear weapons right now. Absolutely, that would be the easiest thing. You don't have to drop on Jordan or on Israel. You go out in the desert and you blow one up as a test, and say we've got three more right now on warheads somewhere in the mountains, and everything ends really, really quickly. That's the reality of it. The moment you're dealing with a nuclear power that feels existentially threatened and is willing to use nuclear weapons, everything changes. The logic changes fast. And by the way, is going to be the message that's already been sent to every single regional power in the world. You want the U.S. off your back? Build nuclear weapons fast. We're going to see a massive Trump. Trump has just... Yeah, he destroyed the world order. I mean, I'll give him that. We're not only economic recession and possible depression in large parts of the world, not only civil unrest in large parts of the world, including the U.S. allies, not possibly toppling of regimes in the Persian Gulf, up and down these little dictatorships that were backed by American military power. We're going to see a lot of changes in the next year, half a year, and a lot of these. But everybody that has half a brain cell working is going to go, oh, nuclear weapons. Whether they're developing them or buying them, they could easily buy them from Pakistan. They could easily buy them from North Korea. There's going to be a big market for nuclear weapons for everybody around. The genie's out of the bottle, and everybody's seen, North Korea doesn't get attacked. Iran got attacked. Why is that? And that's an obvious answer.
Stanislav, as we're wrapping up, just got a report now from one of our sources. We're trying to verify it. But there's a lot of reports coming out that there's a direct strike of an Iranian ballistic missiles in Dimona, where the nuclear power plant is in Israel. And maybe I could just quickly... And there's multiple injuries are allegedly reported there. How significant is that if the nuke plant was actually struck?
It depends where you strike it. The nuclear towers, the cooling towers, I mean, they're designed so they can they can withstand a strike from a Boeing 747 slamming into them. Destroying the cooling towers is difficult. But what's not difficult, which, by the way, the Ukrainians have been trying to do when Zaporizhzhia power plant and in the Kursk power plant when they had the Kursk incursion, which was only about 10% of Kursk, but it gave them the range, was to strike the coolant systems and the backup generators. If you strike the coolant systems, the system that pumps the water in to cool the tank that has the nuclear power rods in it, you could have a meltdown relatively quickly after that. They will heat up. They will go critical. Well, critical isn't a chain reaction like on a nuclear bomb. They'll go critical heat. They'll melt down, and then they'll go melt through the bottom because the level of the heat, they'll melt through the bottom, and you will have a steam explosion. What saved Chernobyl was three guys went underwater underneath where the water reserve was, and they drained it before the core was able to melt its way down to there. Because if the core had hit that water reserve, you would have had a massive steam explosion that would have covered even more of Europe in nuclear fallout, because the radioactive material would have been up in the atmosphere with the steam. So yeah, it's if you take out the coolant and you take out the back out or you take out the power generators that are used, you can actually get into them to melt down. I mean, look, electricity is generated. It's actually not generated, it's excited. You don't create electricity, just the electrons are right there in the wires. You get them going by getting the magnets moving. You get the magnets moving in different variations, how you do it, with steam. But steam turns to generators. It's the question of how do you heat the water? You heat it with nuclear, you heat it with gas, you heat it by burning coal, you heat it by something that's generating heat. So in this case, I mean, you have to have a lot of water, A, for the steam, and B, for the coolant in nuclear power plants. So, you know, if you take that out, you're going to have a lot of problems, and you could have a nuclear meltdown.
How much damage or can one ballistic missile cause a nuclear meltdown?
Again, it depends where it hits. If it hits the coolant facilities.
One ballistic missile in the coolant facilities is enough?
I'm not talking about the coolant towers. I'm talking about the equipment that the pumps, the regulators for the coolant. If you take all that out, I mean, I don't know what kind of ballistic missile they fired. You don't know, you know, did they hit straight in? Did they wing it? But theoretically, yes, that's what the Ukrainians have been trying to do with field artillery, shooting at the Zaporizhzhia power plant, trying to hit the coolant facilities. It was a big enough danger that the Zaporizhzhia power plants have been shut down. I mean, there's minimum amount of coolant that has to go in there, but they're not working right now. Why? Because there's a threat that the Ukrainians would start a nuclear meltdown, just because that's the people in power there. And if this hits, this could be a serious thing. But again, let's not forget, the Israelis already hit the Iranian nuclear power plants. Thankfully, they didn't cause a nuclear meltdown. I mean, this is getting very close to a total catastrophe. And the Israelis have already caused a catastrophe, one catastrophe. So, you know, with the oil fire. So this is spiraling out of control, very, very quickly out of any remaining control.
Wow, yeah. All right, Stanislav, really appreciate it. We'll be getting developments on this.
Yep.
So people, by the time we post this interview, people will probably have more clarity on the whether this is true, this report is true, and how much damage it is. But I am seeing a missile video now of a missile avoiding two interceptors and landing in southern Israel just moments ago. So it's pretty significant development. But Stanislav, absolute pleasure as always to have you on the show. Thank you.
Yep. Have a good day.